This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Strange the Dreamer, written by Lainey Taylor, read by Steve West. For Alexandra, unique in the world. Prologue. On the second Sabbat of Twelfth Moon, in the city of Wee, a girl fell from the sky. Her skin was blue, her blood was red. She broke over an iron gate, crimping it on impact. And there she hung, impossibly arched, graceful as a temple dancer swooning on a lover's arm. One slick finial anchored her in place. Its point, protruding from her sternum, glittered like a brooch. She fluttered briefly as her ghost shook loose, and torch ginger buds rained out of her long hair. Later, they would say these had been hummingbird hearts, and not blossoms at all. They would say she hadn't shed blood, but wept it. That she was lewd, tonguing her teeth at them, upside down and dying. That she vomited a serpent that turned to smoke when it hit the ground. They would say a flock of moths came, frantic, and tried to lift her away. That was true. Only that. They hadn't a prayer, though. The moths were no bigger than the startled mouths of children, and even dozens together could only pluck at the strands of her darkening hair until their wings sagged, sodden with her blood. They were pearled away with the blossoms as a grit-choked gust came blasting down the street. The earth heaved underfoot. The sky spun on its axis. A queer brilliance lanced through billowing smoke, and the people of Weep had to squint against it. Blowing grit and hot light and the stink of saltpeter. There'd been an explosion. They might have died, all and easily. But only this girl had. Shaken from some pocket of the sky. Her feet were bare, her mouth stained damson. Her pockets were all full of plums. She was young and lovely and surprised and dead. She was also blue. Blue as opals, pale blue. Blue as cornflowers, or dragonfly wings, or a spring, not summer, sky. Someone screamed. The scream drew others. The others screamed too. Not because the girl was dead, but because the girl was blue. And this meant something in the city of Weep. Even after the sky stopped reeling, and the earth settled, and the last fumes spluttered from the blast site and dispersed, the screams went on, feeding themselves from voice to voice, a virus of the air. The blue girl's ghost gathered itself and perched, bereft, upon the spear-point tip of the projecting finial, just an inch above her own still chest. Gasping in shock, she tilted back her invisible head and gazed, mournfully up. The screams went on and on. And across the city, atop a monolithic wedge of seamless, mirror-smooth metal, a statue stirred, as though awakened by the tumult, and slowly lifted its great horned head. Part 1. Shrestha. Noun. When a dream comes true, but not for the dreamer. Archaic, from Shres, the bastard god of fortune, who was believed to punish supplicants for inadequate offerings by granting their heart's desire to another. Chapter 1. Mysteries of Weep. Names may be lost or forgotten. No one knew that better than Laszlo Strange. He'd had another name first, but it had died like a song with no one left to sing it. Maybe it had been an old family name, burnished by generations of use. Maybe it had been given to him by someone who loved him. He liked to think so, but he had no idea. All he had were Laszlo and Strange. Strange because that was the surname given to all foundlings in the kingdom of Zosma, and Laszlo after a monk's tongueless uncle.
He had it cut out on a prison galley.
Brother Argos told him when he was old enough to understand. He was an eerie silent man, and you were an eerie silent babe. So it came to me. Laszlo. I had to name so many babies that year, I went with whatever popped into my head. He added, as an afterthought, didn't think you'd live anyway. That was the year Zosma sank to its knees, and bled great gouts of men into a war about nothing. The war, of course, did not content itself with soldiers. Fields were burned, villages pillaged. Bands of displaced peasants roamed the razed countryside, fighting the crows for gleanings. So many died that the tumbrils used to cart thieves to the gallows were repurposed to carry orphans to the monasteries and convents. They arrived like shipments of lambs, to hear the monks tell it, and with no more knowledge of their provenance than lambs, either. Some were old enough to know their names, at least, but Laszlo was just a baby, and an ill one, no less.
"Grey as rain, you were," Brother Argos said. "Thought sure you'd die. But you ate and you slept, and your colour came normal in time. Never cried, never once. And that was unnatural. But we liked you for it fine. None of us became monks to be nursemaids."
To which the child Laszlo replied, with fire in his soul,
"And none of us became children to be orphans."
But an orphan he was, and a strange. And though he was prone to fantasy, he never had any delusions about that. Even as a little boy, he understood that there would be no revelations. No one was coming for him, and he would never know his own true name. Which is perhaps why the mystery of Weep captured him so completely. There were two mysteries, actually. One old, one new. The old one opened his mind, but it was the new one that climbed inside, turned several circles, and settled in with a grunt, like a satisfied dragon in a cozy new lair. And there it would remain, the mystery in his mind, exhaling enigma for years to come. It had to do with a name, and the discovery that, in addition to being lost or forgotten, they could also be stolen. He was 5 years old when it happened, a charity boy at Zeminin Abbey, and he'd snuck away to the old orchard that was the haunt of nightwings and lacewings to play by himself. It was early winter. The trees were black and bare. His feet breached a crust of frost with every step, and the cloud of his breath accompanied him like a chummy ghost. The Angelus rang, its bronze voice pouring through the sheepfold and over the orchard walls in slow, rich waves. It was a call to prayer. If he didn't go in, he would be missed, and if he was missed, he would be whipped. He didn't go in. Laszlo was always finding ways to slip off on his own, and his legs were always striped from the hazel switch that hung from a hook with his name on it. It was worth it. To get away from the monks and the rules and the chores and the life that pinched like tight shoes. To play.
"Turn back now if you know what's good for you,"
he warned imaginary enemies. He held a sword in each hand, black apple branches with the stout ends bound in twine to make hilts. He was a small, underfed waif with cuts on his head where the monks nicked it, shaving it against lice. But he held himself with exquisite dignity, and there could be no doubt that in his own mind, in that moment, he was a warrior. And not just any warrior, but a Tizerkane, fiercest that ever was.
"No outsider,"
he told his foes,
"has ever set eyes on the Forbidden City, and as long as I draw breath, none ever will."
"We're in luck, then,"
the foes replied, and they were more real to him in the twilight than the monks whose chanting drifted downhill from the abbey.
"Because you won't be drawing breath for much longer."
Laszlo's grey eyes narrowed to slits.
"You think you can defeat me?"
The black trees danced. His breath ghost scudded away on a gust, only to be replaced by another. His shadow splayed out huge before him, and his mind gleamed with ancient wars and winged beings, a mountain of melted demon bones, and the city on the far side of it. A city that had vanished in the mists of time. This was the old mystery. It had come to him from a senile monk, Brother Cyrus. He was an invalid, and it fell to the charity boys to bring him his meals. He wasn't kind. No grandfather figure. No mentor. He had a terrible grip, and was known to hold the boys by the wrist for hours, forcing them to repeat nonsense catechisms and confess to all manner of wickedness they could scarce understand, let alone have committed. They all had a terror of him and his gnarled raptor hands, and the bigger boys, sooner than protect the smaller, sent them to his lair in their stead. Laszlo was as scared as the rest, yet he volunteered to bring all the meals. Why? Because Brother Cyrus told stories. Stories were not smiled upon at the abbey. At best, they distracted from spiritual contemplation. At worst, they honored false gods and festered into sin. But Brother Cyrus had gone beyond such strictures. His mind had slipped its moorings. He never seemed to understand where he was, and his confusion infuriated him. His face grew clenched and red. Spittle flew when he ranted. But he had his moments of calm, when he slipped through some cellar door in his memory, back to his boyhood, and the stories his grandmother used to tell him. He couldn't remember the other monks' names, or even the prayers that had been his vocation for decades. But the stories poured from him, and Laszlo listened. He listened the way a cactus drinks rain. In the south and east of the continent of Namar, far, far from the northerly Zosma, there was a vast desert called the Elmuthaleth, the crossing of which was an art perfected by few and fiercely guarded against all others. Somewhere across its emptiness lay a city that had never been seen. It was a rumor, a fable, but it was a rumor and fable from which marvels emerged, carried by camels across the desert to fire the imaginations of folk the world over. The city had a name. The men who drove the camels, who brought the marvels, they told the name and they told stories, and the name and the stories made their way, with the marvels, to distant lands, where they conjured visions of glittering domes and tame white stags, women so beautiful they melted the mind, and men whose scimitars blinded with their shine. For centuries this was so. Wings of palaces were devoted to the marvels, and shelves of libraries to the stories. Traders grew rich, adventurers grew bold, and went to find the city for themselves. None returned. It was forbidden to Ferengi, outsiders, who, if they survived the Elmuthaleth crossing, were executed as spies. Not that that stopped them from trying. Forbid a man something, and he craves it like his soul's salvation. All the more so when that something is the source of incomparable riches. Many tried. None ever returned. The desert horizon birthed sun after sun, and it seemed as if nothing would ever change. But then, 200 years ago, the caravans stopped coming. In the western outposts of the Elmuthaleth, Alkanost and others, they watched for the heat-distorted silhouettes of camel trains to emerge from the emptiness, as they always had. But they did not. And they did not. And they did not. There were no more camels, no more men, no more marvels, and no more stories. Ever. That was the last that was ever heard from the Forbidden City, the Unseen City, the Lost City. And this was the mystery that had opened Laszlo's mind like a door. What had happened? Did the city still exist? He wanted to know everything. He learned to coax Brother Cyrus into that place of reverie, and he collected the stories like treasure. Laszlo owned nothing, not one single thing, but from the first, the stories felt like his own hoard of gold. The domes of the city, Brother Cyrus said, were all connected by silk ribbons, and children balanced upon them like tightrope walkers, dashing from palace to palace in capes of coloured feathers. No doors were ever closed to them, and even the bird cages were open for the birds to come and go as they pleased. And wondrous fruits grew everywhere, ripe for the plucking, and cakes were left out on window ledges, free for the taking. Laszlo had never even seen cake, let alone tasted it. And he'd been whipped for eating windfall apples that were more worm than fruit. These visions of freedom and plenty bewitched him. Certainly they distracted from spiritual contemplation, but in the same way that the sight of a shooting star distracts from the ache of an empty belly. They marked his first consideration that there might be other ways of living than the one he knew. Better, sweeter ways. The streets of the city, Brother Cyrus said, were tiled with lapis lazuli and kept scrupulously clean so as not to soil the long, long hair the ladies wore loose and trailing behind them like bolts of blackest silk. Elegant white stags roamed the streets like citizens, and reptiles big as men drifted in the river. The first were spectrals, and the substance of their antlers, spectralis or lis, was more precious than gold. The second were spitagores, whose pink blood was an elixir of immortality. There were rabbits, too, great cats with fangs like scythes, and birds that mimicked human voices, and scorpions whose sting imparted superhuman strength. And there were the Tizercane warriors. They wielded blades called Hreshtek, sharp enough to slice a man of... and kept scorpions in brass cages hooked to their belts. Before battle, they would thrust a finger through a small opening to be stung, and under the influence of the venom, they were unstoppable.
You think you can defeat me?
Laszlo defied his orchard foes.
There are 100 of us, they replied, and only one of you. What do you think?
I think you should believe every story you've ever heard about the Tizercane and turn around and go home.
Their laughter sounded like the creaking of branches, and Laszlo had no choice but to fight. He poked his finger into the little lopsided cage of twigs and twine that dangled from his rope belt. There was no scorpion in it, only a beetle stunned by the cold. But he gritted his teeth against an imagined sting and felt venom bloom power in his blood. And then he lifted his blades, arms raised in a V, and roared. He roared the city's name, like thunder, like an avalanche, like the war cry of the seraphim who had come on wings of fire and cleansed the world of demons. His foes stumbled. They gaped. The venom sang in him. And he was something more than human. He was a whirlwind. He was a god. They tried to fight, but they were no match for him. His swords flashed lightning as, two by two, he disarmed them all. In the thick of play, his daydreams were so vivid that a glimpse of reality would have shocked him. If he could have stood apart and seen the little boy crashing through the frost-stiff bracken, waving branches around, he would scarcely have recognized himself. So deeply did he inhabit the warrior in his mind's eye, who had just disarmed 100 enemies and sent them staggering home. In triumph, he tipped back his head and let out a cry of...
Weep!
He froze, confused. The word had broken from his mouth like a curse, leaving an aftertaste of tears. He had reached for the city's name, as he had just a moment ago, but it was gone. He tried again, and again found weep instead. It was like putting out his hand for a flower and coming back with a slug or sodden handkerchief. His mind recoiled from it. He couldn't stop trying, though, and each time was worse than the one before. He groped for what he knew had been there, and all he fished up was the awful word, weep, slick with wrongness, damp as bad dreams, and tinged with its residue of salt. His mouth curled with its bitterness. A feeling of vertigo swept over him, and the mad certainty that it had been taken. It had been taken from his mind. He felt sick, robbed, diminished. He raced back up the slope, scrabbling over low stone walls, and pelted through the sheepfold, past the garden and through the cloister, still gripping his apple branch swords. He saw no one, but was seen. There was a rule against running, and anyway, he ought to have been at Vespers. He ran straight to Brother Cyrus's cell and shook him awake.
"The name,"
he said, gasping for breath.
"The name is missing. The city from the stories. Tell me its name."
He knew deep down that he hadn't forgotten it, that this was something else, something dark and strange. But there was still the chance that maybe Brother Cyrus would remember and all would be well. But Brother Cyrus said,
"What do you mean, you fool boy? It's Weep!"
And Laszlo had just time to see the old man's face buckle with confusion before a hand closed on his collar and yanked him out the door.
"Wait!"
he implored.
"Please!"
To no avail. He was dragged all the way to the abbot's office, and when they whipped him this time, it wasn't with his hazel switch, which hung in a row with all the other boys' switches, but one of his apple boughs. He was no Tizer Cain now. Never mind 100 enemies. He was disarmed by a single monk and beaten with his own sword. Some hero. He limped for weeks and was forbidden from seeing Brother Cyrus, who had grown so agitated by his visit that he'd had to be sedated. There were no more stories after that, and no more escapes. At least, not into the orchard, or anywhere outside his own mind. The monks kept a sharp eye on him, determined to keep him free of sin. And of joy, which, if not explicitly a sin, at least clears a path to it. He was kept busy. If he wasn't working, he was praying. If he wasn't praying, he was working. Always under adequate supervision, to prevent his vanishing like a wild creature into the trees. At night he slept, exhausted as a gravedigger, too tired even to dream. It did seem as though the fire in him was smothered. The thunder and the avalanche, the war cry and the whirlwind, all stamped out. As for the name of the vanished city, it had vanished too. Laszlo would always remember the feel of it in his mind, though. It had felt like calligraphy, if calligraphy were written in honey, and that was as close to it as he, or anyone, could come. It wasn't just him and Brother Cyrus. Wherever the name had been found, printed on the spines of books that held its stories, in the old yellowed ledgers of merchants who'd bought its goods, and woven into the memories of anyone who'd ever heard it, it was simply erased, and Weep was left in its place. This was the new mystery. This, he never doubted, was magic. Chapter 2. The Dream Chooses the Dreamer. Laszlo grew up. No one would ever call him lucky, but it could have been worse. Among the monasteries that took in foundlings, one was a flagellant order, another raised hogs. But Zeminin Abbey was famous for its scriptorium. The boys were early trained to copy, though not to read. He had to teach himself that part. And those with any skill were drafted into scribing. Skill he had, and he might have stayed there his whole life, bent over a desk, his neck growing forward instead of upright, had not the brothers taken ill one day from bad fish. This was luck, or perhaps fate. Some manuscripts were expected at the great library of Zosma, and Laszlo was charged to deliver them. He never came back. The great library was no mere place to keep books. It was a walled city for poets and astronomers, and every shade of thinker in between. It encompassed not only the vast archives, but the university too, together with laboratories and glasshouses, medical theatres and music rooms, and even a celestial observatory. All this occupied what had been the royal palace, before the current queen's grandfather built a finer one, straddling the Ader, and gifted this one to the Scholars' Guild. It ranged across the top of Zosimos Ridge, which knifed up from Zosma City like a shark's fin, and was visible from miles away. Laszlo was in a state of awe from the moment he passed through the gates. His mouth actually fell open when he saw the Pavilion of Thought. That was the grandiose name for the ballroom that now housed the library's philosophy texts. Shelves rose 40 feet under an astonishing painted ceiling, and the spines of books glowed in jewel-toned leather, their gold leaf shining in the glaive light like animal eyes. The glaives themselves were perfect polished spheres, hanging by the hundreds and emitting a purer white light than he'd ever seen from the rough, ruddy stones that lit the abbey. Men in grey robes rode upon wheeled ladders, seeming to float through the air, scrolls flapping behind them like wings as they rolled from shelf to shelf. It was impossible that he should leave this place. He was like a traveller in an enchanted wood. Every step deeper bewitched him further, and deeper he did go, from room to room, as though guided by instinct, down secret stairs to a sub-level where dust lay thick on books undisturbed for years. He disturbed them. It seemed to him that he awoke them, and they awoke him. He was 13, and he hadn't played Tizocaine for years. He hadn't played anything, or strayed out of step. At the Abbey, he was one more grey-clad figure going where he was told, working, praying, chanting, praying, working, praying, sleeping. Few of the brothers even remembered his wildness now. It seemed all gone out of him. In fact, it had just gone deep. The stories were still there. Every word that Brother Cyrus had ever told him. He cherished them like a little stash of gold in a corner of his mind. That day, the stash grew bigger. Much bigger. The books under the dust, they were stories. Folk tales, fairy tales, myths and legends. They spanned the whole world. They went back centuries and longer, and whole shelves of them, entire, beautiful shelves, were stories of weep. He lifted one down with more reverence than he'd ever felt for the sacred texts of the Abbey, blew off the dust, and began to read. He was found, days later, by a senior librarian, but only because the man was looking for him, a letter from the abbot in the pocket of his robes. Elsewise, Laszlo might have lived down there like a boy in a cave for who knows how long. He might have grown feral, the wild boy of the great library, versed in 3 dead languages and all the tales ever written in them, but ragged as a beggar in the alleys of the Grin. Instead, he was taken on as an apprentice.
"The library knows its own mind,"
old Master Hurricane told him, leading him back up the secret stairs.
"When it steals a boy, we let it keep him."
Laszlo couldn't have belonged at the library more truly if he were a book himself. In the days that followed, and in the months and years as he grew into a man, he was rarely to be seen without one open in front of his face. He read while he walked. He read while he ate. The other librarians suspected he somehow read while he slept, or perhaps didn't sleep at all. On the occasions that he did look up from the page, it would seem as though he were awakening from a dream. Strange the Dreamer, they called him. That dreamer, Strange. And it didn't help that he sometimes walked into walls while reading, or that his favorite books hailed from that dusty sublevel where no one else cared to go. He drifted about with his head full of myths, always at least half lost in some other land of story. Demons and wingsmiths, seraphim and spirits, he loved it all. He believed in magic, like a child, and in ghosts, like a peasant. His nose was broken by a falling volume of fairy tales his first day on the job, and that, they said, told you everything you needed to know about strange Laszlo Strange. Head in the clouds, world of his own, fairy tales and fancy. That was what they meant when they called him a dreamer, and they weren't wrong. But they missed the main point. Laszlo was a dreamer in more profound a way than they knew. That is to say, he had a dream. A guiding and abiding one. So much a part of him it was like a second soul inside his skin. The landscape of his mind was all given over to it. It was a deep and ravishing landscape, and a daring and magnificent dream. Too daring, too magnificent for the likes of him. He knew that. But the dream chooses the dreamer, not the other way around.
"What's that you're reading, Strange?"
asked Master Hurrikan, hobbling up behind him at the inquiry's desk.
"Love letter, I hope?"
The old librarian expressed this wish more often than was seemly, undaunted that the answer was always no. Laszlo was on the verge of making his usual response, but paused, considering.
"In a way," he said,
and held out the paper, which was brittle and yellowed with age. A gleam lit Master Hurrikan's faded brown eyes, but when he adjusted his spectacles and looked at the page, the gleam winked out.
"This appears to be a receipt,"
he observed.
"Ah, but a receipt for what?"
Skeptical, Master Hurrikan squinted to read, then gave a crack of a laugh that turned every head in the huge, hushed room. They were in the Pavilion of Thought. Scholars in scarlet robes were hunched at long tables, and they all looked up from their scrolls and tomes, eyes grim with disapproval. Master Hurrikan bobbed a nod of apology and handed Laszlo back the paper, which was an old bill for a very large shipment of aphrodisiacs to a long-dead king.
"Seems he wasn't called the Amorous King for his poetry, eh? But what are you doing? Tell me this isn't what it looks like. For God's sake, boy, tell me you aren't archiving receipts on your free day."
Laszlo was a boy no longer. No trace remaining, outwardly, of the small, bald foundling with cuts on his head. He was tall now, and he'd let his hair grow long, once he was free of the monks and their dull razors. It was dark and heavy, and he tied it back with bookbinder's twine, and spared it very little thought. His brows were dark and heavy too, his features strong and broad. Rough-hewn, some might have said, or even thuggish, on account of his broken nose, which made a sharp angle in profile, and from the front skewed distinctly to the left. He had a raw, rugged look, and sound, too, his voice low and masculine, and not at all smooth, as though it had been left out in the weather. In all this, his dreamer's eyes were incongruous, grey and wide and guileless. Just now they weren't quite meeting Master Hurrikan's gaze.
"Of course not," he said unconvincingly. "What kind of maniac would archive receipts on his free day?"
"Then what are you doing?"
He shrugged.
"A steward found an old box of bills in a cellar. I'm just having a look."
"Well, it's a shocking waste of youth. How old are you now? 18?
20,
Laszlo reminded him, though in truth he couldn't be certain, having chosen a birthday at random when he was a boy.
"And you wasted your youth the same way."
"And I'm a cautionary tale. Look at me."
Laszlo did. He saw a soft, stooped creature of a man, whose dandelion fluff hair, beard, and brows encroached upon his face to such a degree that only his sharp little nose and round spectacles showed. He looked, Laszlo thought, like an owlet fallen out of its nest.
"Do you want to end your days a half blind troglodyte hobbling through the bowels of the library?"
the old man demanded.
"Get out of doors, Strange. Breathe air. See things. A man should have squint lines from looking at the horizon, not just from reading in dim light.
What's a horizon? Laszlo asked, straight-faced. Is it like the end of an aisle of books?
No, said Master Hurricane. Not in any way.
Laszlo smiled and went back to the receipts. Well, that word made them sound dull, even in his head. They were old cargo manifests, which sounded marginally more thrilling, from a time when the palace had been the royal residence, and goods had come from every corner of the world. He wasn't archiving them. He was skimming them for the telltale flourishes of a particular rare alphabet. He was looking, as he always was on some level, for hints of the unseen city, which was how he chose to think of it, since weep still brought the taste of tears.
I'll go in a moment, he assured Master Hurricane.
It might not have seemed like it, but he took the old man's words to heart. He had, in fact, no wish to end his days at the library, half blind or otherwise, and every hope of earning his squint lines by looking at the horizon. The horizon he wished to look at, however, was very far away. And also, incidentally, forbidden. Master Hurricane gestured to a window.
You're at least aware, I hope, that it's summer out there.
When Laszlo didn't respond, he added,
Large orange orb in the sky, low necklines on the fairer sex. Any of this ring a bell?
Still nothing.
Strange?
What? Laszlo looked up. He hadn't heard a word. He'd found what he was looking for. A sheaf of bills from the unseen city, and it had stolen his attention away. The old librarian gave a theatrical sigh.
Do as you will, he said,
half doom and half resignation.
Just take care. The books may be immortal, but we are not. You go down to the stacks one morning, and by the time you come up, you've a beard down to your belly and have never once composed a poem to a girl you met ice skating on the Ada.
Is that how one meets girls? Asked Laszlo, only half in jest.
Well, the river won't freeze for months. I have time to rally my courage.
Bah! Girls are not a hibernal phenomenon. Go now! Pick some flowers and find one to give them to. It's as simple as that. Look for kind eyes and wide hips. Do you hear me? Hips, boy. You haven't lived until you've laid your head on a nice, soft...
Mercifully, he was interrupted by the approach of a scholar. Laszlo could as easily will his skin to turn colour as he could approach and speak to a girl, let alone lay his head on a nice, soft anything. Between the abbey and the library, he had hardly known a female person, much less a young female person. And even if he'd had the faintest idea what to say to one, he didn't imagine that many would welcome the overtures of a penniless junior librarian with a crooked nose and the ignominious name of Strange. The scholar left, and Master Hurricane resumed his lecture.
Life won't just happen to you, boy, he said. You have to happen to it. Remember, the spirit grows sluggish when you neglect the passions.
My spirit is fine.
Then you're going sadly wrong. You're young. Your spirit shouldn't be fine. It should be effervescent.
The spirit in question wasn't the soul. Nothing so abstract. It was spirit of the body, the clear fluid pumped by the second heart through its own network of vessels, subtler and more mysterious than the primary vascular system. Its function wasn't properly understood by science. You could live even if your second heart stopped and the spirit hardened in your veins. But it did have some connection to vitality, or passion, as Master Hurricane said. And those without it were emotionless, lethargic, spiritless.
Worry about your own spirit, Laszlo told him. It's not too late for you. I'm sure plenty of widows would be delighted to be wooed by such a romantic troglodyte.
Don't be impertinent.
Don't be imperious.
Master Hurricane sighed.
I miss the days when you lived in fear of me, however short-lived they were.
Laszlo laughed.
You had the monks to thank for those. They taught me to fear my elders. You taught me not to, and for that, I'll always be grateful.
He said it warmly, and then he couldn't help himself. His eyes flickered toward the papers in his hand. The old man saw and let out a huff of exasperation.
Fine, fine. Enjoy your receipts. I'm not giving up on you, though. What's the point of being old if you can't beleaguer the young with your vast stores of wisdom?
And what's the point of being young if you can't ignore all advice?
Master Hurricane grumbled and turned his attention to the stack of folios that had just been returned to the desk. Laszlo turned his to his small discovery. Silence reigned in the pavilion of thought, broken only by the wheels of ladders and the shush of pages turning. And, after a moment, by a low, slow whistle from Laszlo, whose discovery, it transpired, wasn't so small after all. Master Hurricane perked up.
More love potions?
No, said Laszlo. Look.
The old man performed his usual adjustment of spectacles and peered at the paper.
Ah,
he said with the air of the long-suffering.
Mysteries of Weep. I might have known.
Weep. The name struck Laszlo as an unpleasant twinge behind his eyes. The condescension struck him too, but it didn't surprise him. Generally, he kept his fascination to himself. No one understood it, much less shared it. There had been, once upon a time, a great deal of curiosity surrounding the vanished city and its fate. But after 2 centuries, it had become little more than a fable. And as for the uncanny business of the name, in the world at large, it hadn't caused much stir. Only Laszlo had felt it happen. Others had learned of it later, through a slow trickle of rumors. And to them it just felt like something they'd forgotten. Some did whisper of a conspiracy or a trick, but most decided, firmly closing a door in their minds, that it had always been Weep, and any claims to the contrary were nonsense and fairy dust. There just wasn't any other explanation that made sense. Certainly not magic. Laszlo knew that Master Hurricane wasn't interested, but he was too excited to mind.
Just read it, he said,
and held the paper under the old man's nose. Master Hurricane did, and failed to be impressed.
Well, what of it?
What of it? Among the goods listed, spice and silk and the like, was an entry for Svitogor blood candy. Up until now, Laszlo had only ever seen it referred to in tales. It was considered folklore that the river monsters even existed, let alone that their pink blood was harvested as an elixir of immortality. But here it was, bought and paid for by the royal house of Zosma. There might as well have been an entry for dragon scales.
Blood candy, he said, pointing. Don't you see? It was real.
Master Hurricane snorted.
This makes it real. If it was real, whoever ate it would still be alive to tell you so.
Not so, argued Laszlo. In the stories, you were only immortal so long as you kept eating it. And that wouldn't have been possible once the shipment stopped.
He pointed out the date on the bill.
This is 200 years old. It might even have come from the last caravan.
The last caravan ever to emerge from the Elmuthaleth. Laszlo imagined an empty desert, a setting sun. As always, Anything touching on the mysteries had a quickening effect on him, like a drumbeat pulling at his pulse, at both his pulses, blood and spirit, the rhythms of his two hearts interwoven like the syncopation of two hands beating at different drums. When he first came to the library, he thought surely he would find answers here. There were the books of stories in the dusty sublevel, of course, but there was so much more than that. The very history of the world, it had seemed to him, was all bound into covers or rolled into scrolls and archived on the shelves of this wondrous place. In his naivete, he'd thought even the secrets must be hidden away here, for those with the will and patience to look for them. He had both, and for 7 years now he'd been looking. He'd searched old journals and bundled correspondences, spies' reports, maps and treaties, trade ledgers, and the minutes of royal secretaries, and anything else he could dig up. And the more he learned, the more the little stash of treasure had grown, until it spilled from its corner to quite fill his mind. It had also spilled onto paper. As a boy at the Abbey, stories had been Laszlo's only wealth. He was richer now. Now he had books. His books were his books, you understand. His words, penned in his own hand and bound with his own neat stitches. No gold leaf on leather, like the books in the Pavilion of Thought. These were humble. In the beginning, he'd fished paper from the bins, half-used sheets that thriftless scholars had tossed away, and he'd made do with the snipped ends of binder's twine from the book infirmary where they made repairs. Ink was hard to come by, but here, too, scholars unwittingly helped. They threw away bottles that still had a good quarter inch at the bottom. He'd had to water it down, so his earliest volumes were filled with pale ghost words. But after a few years, he'd begun to draw a pittance of a salary that enabled him to at least buy ink. He had a lot of books, all lined up on the window ledge in his little room. They contained 7 years of research, and every hint and titbit that was to be found about Weep and its pair of mysteries. They did not contain answers to them. Somewhere along the way, Laszlo had accepted that the answers weren't here, not in all these tomes on all these great, vast shelves. And how could they be? Had he imagined that the library had omniscient fairies on staff to record everything that happened in the world, no matter how secret or how far away? No. If the answers were anywhere, they were in the south and east of the continent of Namar, on the far side of the El Muthaleth, whence no one had ever returned. Did the unseen city still stand? Did its people yet live? What happened 200 years ago? What happened 15 years ago? What power could erase a name from the minds of the world? Laszlo wanted to go and find out. That was his dream, daring and magnificent. To go there, half across the world, and solve the mysteries for himself. It was impossible, of course. But when did that ever stop any dreamer from dreaming? Chapter 3. The Complete Works of Laszlo Strange. Master Hurricane was immune to Laszlo's wonder.
"They're stories, boy. Stuff and fantasy. There was no elixir of immortality. If anything, it was just sugared blood."
"But look at the price," Laszlo insisted. "Would they have paid that for sugared blood?"
"What do we know of what kings will pay? That's proof of nothing but a rich man's gullibility."
Laszlo's excitement began to wane.
"You're right," he admitted.
The receipt proved that something called blood candy had been purchased, but nothing more than that. He wasn't ready to give up, though.
"It suggests, at least, that Svitogors were real."
He paused.
"Maybe."
"What if they were?" said Master Hurricane. "We'll never know."
He put a hand on Laszlo's shoulder.
"You're not a child any more. Isn't it time to let all this go?"
He had no visible mouth, his smile discernible only as a ripple where his dandelion fluffed moustache overlapped his beard.
You've plenty of work for little enough pay. Why add more for none? No one's going to thank you for it. Our job is to find books. Leave it to the scholars to find answers.
He meant well. Laszlo knew that. The old man was a creature of the library through and through. Its caste system was, to him, the just rule of a perfect world. Within these walls, scholars were the aristocracy, and everyone else their servants, especially the librarians, whose directive was to support them in their important work. Scholars were graduates of the universities. Librarians were not. They might have the minds for it, but none had the gold. Their apprenticeship was their education. And, depending on the librarian, it might surpass a scholar's own. But a butler might surpass his master in gentility and remain, nevertheless, the butler. So it was for librarians. They weren't forbidden to study, so long as it didn't interfere with their duties. But it was understood that it was for their personal enlightenment alone, and made no contribution to the world's body of knowledge.
Why let scholars have all the fun? Laszlo asked. Besides, no one studies weep.
That's because it's a dead subject, Master Hyrkan said. Scholars occupy their minds with important matters.
He placed gentle emphasis on important. And just then, as if to illustrate his point, the door swung open and a scholar strode in. The Pavilion of Thought had been a ballroom. Its doors were twice the height of normal doors, and more than twice the width. Most scholars who came and went found it adequate to open one of them, then quietly close it behind himself. But not this man. He laid a hand to each massive door and thrust, and by the time they hit the walls and shuddered, he was well through them, boot heels ringing on the marble floor, his long, sure stride unhindered by the swish of robes. He disdained full regalia, except on ceremonial occasions, and dressed instead in impeccable coats and breeches, with tall black riding boots and a dueling blade at his side. His only nod to Scholar Scarlet was his cravat, which was always of that colour. He was no ordinary scholar, this man, but the apotheosis of scholars. The most famous personage in Zosma, save the Queen and the Hierarch, and the most popular, bar none. He was young and glorious and golden. He was Thion Nero the Alchemist, second son of the Duke of Val, and godson to the Queen. Heads lifted at the jarring of the doors, but unlike the irritation mirrored on all faces when Master Hyrkan had laughed, this time they registered surprise, before shifting into adulation or envy. Master Hyrkan's reaction was pure adulation. He lit up like a glaive at the sight of the alchemist. Once upon a time, Laszlo would have done the same. Not any more. Though no one was looking at him to notice the way he froze like a prey creature and seemed to shrink at the approach of the golden godson, whose purposeful stride carried him straight to the inquiry's desk. This visit was out of the ordinary. Thion Nero had assistants to perform such tasks for him.
"My lord,"
said Master Hyrkan, straightening as much as his old back would allow.
"It's so good of you to visit us. But you needn't trouble yourself to come in person. We know you've more important things to attend to than running errands."
The librarian shot Laszlo a sideward glance. Here, in case Laszlo might miss his meaning, was the best possible example of a scholar occupying his mind with important matters. And with what important matters did Thion Nero occupy his mind? With no less than the animating principle of the universe, Azoth, the secret essence alchemists had sought for centuries. He had distilled it at the age of 16, enabling him to work miracles. Among them the highest aspiration of the ancient art, the transmutation of lead into gold. That's good of you, Hyrrican, said this paragon, who had the face of a god in addition to the mind of one. But I thought I'd better come myself. He held up a rolled request form, so that there could be no question whether this was a mistake.
A mistake? There was no need, my lord,
Master Hyrrican assured him.
There could be no quibbling with a request of yours, no matter who delivered it. We're here to serve, not to question.
I'm glad to hear that, said Nero, with the smile that had been known to render parlours full of ladies mute and dazed. And then he looked at Laszlo. It was so unexpected. It was like sudden immersion in ice water. Laszlo hadn't moved since the doors burst open. This was what he did when Thion Nero was near. He seized up and felt as invisible as the alchemist pretended he was. He was accustomed to cutting silence and a cool gaze that slid past him as though he didn't exist. So the look came as a shock, and his words, when he spoke, an even greater one.
And you, strange, are you here to serve or to question?
He was cordial, but his blue eyes held a brightness that filled Laszlo with dread.
To serve, my lord, he answered,
his voice as brittle as the papers in his hands.
Good.
Nero held his gaze, and Laszlo had to battle the urge to look away. They stared at each other, the alchemist and the librarian. They held a secret between them, and it burned like alchemical fire. Even old Master Hyrrican felt it, and glanced uneasily between the two young men. Nero looked like a prince from some saga told by firelight, all luster and gleam. Laszlo's skin hadn't been grey since he was a baby, but his librarian's robes were, and his eyes too, as though that colour were his fate. He was quiet, and had a shadow's talent for passing unremarked, while Thion drew all eyes like a flare. Everything about him was as crisp and elegant as freshly pressed silk. He was shaved by a manservant with the blade sharpened daily, and his tailor's bill could have fed a village. By contrast, Laszlo was all rough edges, burlap to Nero's silk. His robe had not been new, even when it came to him a year ago. Its hem was frayed from dragging up and down the rough stone steps of the stacks, and it was large, so the shape of him was quite lost within it. They were the same height, but Nero stood as though posing for a sculptor, while Laszlo's shoulders were curved in a posture of wariness. What did Nero want? Nero turned back to the old man. He held his head high, as though conscious of the perfection of his jawline, and when speaking to someone shorter than himself, lowered only his eyes, not his head. He handed over the request form. Master Hyrrican unrolled the paper, adjusted his spectacles, and read it. And readjusted his spectacles, and read it again. He looked up at Nero, and then he looked at Laszlo, and Laszlo knew. He knew what the request was for. A numbness spread through him. He felt as though his blood and spirit had both ceased to circulate, and the breath in his lungs too.
"Have them delivered to my palace," Nero said.
Master Hyrrican opened his mouth, confounded, but no sound came out. He glanced at Laszlo again, and the glaive light shone on his spectacles, so that Laszlo couldn't see his eyes.
"Do you need me to write out the address?"
Nero asked. His affability was all sham. Everyone knew the riverfront palace of pale pink marble, gifted him by the Queen, and he knew they knew. The address was hardly the issue.
"My lord, of course not," said Master Hyrrican. "It's just,
Is there a problem?" asked Nero. His pleasant tone belied the sharpness of his eyes.
Yes, Laszlo thought. Yes, there is a problem.
But Master Hyrrican quailed under the look.
No, my lord. I'm sure it's an honor.
And the words were a knife in Laszlo's back.
Excellent, said Nero.
That's that, then. I'll expect delivery this evening. And he left as he had come, boot heels ringing on the marble floor, and all eyes following. Laszlo turned to Master Hurricane. His heart hadn't stopped beating after all.